Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett. Thanks for being with us on this Friday afternoon, Saturday morning, depending on where you are. Always great to be with you. We're always grateful that you're here with us. Thanks for taking the time with us. Got an open forum for you. First hour, Jimmy Akin came in, so that's a little bonus. We got a Friday open forum for you, and then we got one of those fun Friday things we like to do, weird questions with Jimmy Akin, second hour. Every single question will be weird. I cannot vouch for the answers. That is entirely up to Jimmy. But all the questions will be weird in the second hour today. First hour, if you want to call with your question, whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884. Jimmy, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Cy Kellett.
Happy Friday to you.
Likewise.
And that means today dropped the second half of the spooky psychic spying episodes, of the two-episode thing on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
If you want to put it that way, sure.
It's not spooky? Which modifier would...
Well, it isn't. It did involve intelligence work, so It was spooky in that sense. You know, spooks, spies.
Oh, I see. Yes, right.
Yeah. So this was part two of an interview I did with Paul Smith, who was one of the original Stargate remote viewers for the government's psychic spying program in the military. And in this episode, we get into not only some really interesting things that happened during the course of the Stargate program, not the TV show, obviously, also, we evaluate remote viewing from the perspectives of faith and reason. And because Paul Smith is a man of faith, obviously so am I, and so we talk about it, you know, and we ask the D question, could it be demons? So we talk about all that stuff. I also shed light coming from a Catholic perspective on what Catholic theologians like St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas have said about psychic powers, and they did not dismiss them
out of hand.
Yeah. Also, I've seen already online in people from the remote viewing community have been very interested in the interview, and in fact, one of the other Stargate psychic spies gave me a like on Facebook for this.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. So when you say remote viewing community, is this a community that gets together, or do they just...
they do get together. I mean, they have like Zoom chats and things like that.
Yeah.
I've hung out on some of those and seen how they interact. And, you know, one thing that's interesting is how sincere they are.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there are in any business, there are people who are just scamming.
Oh, sure. You know? Yeah. And that's, even in our business, in the religion business, there's plenty of scammers.
Yeah, and it's true also, obviously, in the psychic community. There are psychics who are just scammers.
Yeah.
But these people, like, meet on a given afternoon of the week for, like, 2 or 3 hours every week by Zoom.
Oh, yeah.
And in hanging out and watching their discussions, they are not getting together and saying, how can we scam people out of more money?
No, they won't.
How can we pull the wool over their eyes? For hours, they are getting together and saying, how can I improve? How can I be more accurate? What techniques do I need to use?
Wow.
And so they're very sincere about that.
That's fascinating. So you work on it like you might work on any other skill.
Yes, exactly.
I see. 888-318-7884, our number. Jimmy Akin, our guest, an open forum means you can call with any question you've got. Already, lines have a... lit up a light. Thank you. I don't know why I was stuck on that.
Oh, and you've got the nice English up intensifier there, which signals the closing of a process.
Oh, really? Is that what that means?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it tends to like he ate up the food.
Oh, it's and finished. It's finished. Yeah.
Or to quote Mark Twain, the widow fatted up.
Well, she might not be finished. You don't know. She might have some more fattening up to do. Jordan in Hogville, Connecticut, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers Live app. You are next. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. This is Jordan. So I'm a new Catholic. So I just started going to the Catholic Church from, I used to be a Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been reading On the Incarnation by St. Athanasius. And one of the statements that really is profound and is kind of blowing my mind is the statement, God became man, that man might become God. So I was just wondering if you could help explain that for me, because it still seems so incredible and so interesting.
Yeah. So this refers to a process that is, it's an aspect of God's grace. It's referred to in the New Testament. It is in, it's sometimes called theosis, from the Greek word theos, which means God. It's also sometimes called divinization, which is based on Latin roots. So it basically, it's the process by which God uses his grace to enable us to share in certain aspects, certain characteristics that he has, certain aspects of his nature. Theologians distinguish between what are called God's, so God has a variety of attributes, like, for example, he's omnipotent, he can do anything, he's omniscient, he knows everything, he's eternal and uncreated, he's also good and kind and merciful and glorious, and things like that. And theologians will distinguish between different types of attributes. Some they call incommunicable attributes, because God cannot communicate these to us. He can't give them to us. So, for example, he's uncreated and outside of time. Well, he can't make us uncreated. We're created beings. We always will be created beings. Also, we're always inside of time in one way or another. But there are other attributes where God can share them with us so that we can become godly. We can come to share in God's love and compassion. We can become loving, compassionate people. We can share in his holiness. We can become moral people who do moral good and act in a holy way. We also can share in God's glory. You know, St. Paul talks about how we're going to be glorified with God. And there are even senses in which we can come to share in a measure of God's power and knowledge. So these, so he does all this by his grace. St. Peter refers to this in his letters. He talks about how by God's grace we become partakers of the divine nature. And really, that's just another way of saying God is making us godly people. He's allowing us to share in certain of his characteristics. Now, we never become fully God. We never become infinite. We never become uncreated. Those are incommunicable things. But we do come to have a share in certain other divine attributes by God's grace. And that's what St. Athanasius and others are talking about. Now, I should mention there is a mistranslation that sometimes happens of this famous statement by St. Athanasius. In fact, the mistranslation actually, unfortunately, got into the English edition of the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the Latin edition is just fine, but the English version has a mistranslation on this point. And Tim Staples actually wrote an article about that a few years ago. So you might want to check that article out, Jordan, just for a little extra perspective on this. If you Google Tim Staples, Catechism, Athanasius, Might Become God, it should come right up for you.
Okay, Jordan?
Awesome. Thank you so much. That really helps clarify it.
Thank you very much, Jordan. Appreciate it. Our number here is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Two lines open right now, and so you can get in the queue if you like to ask your question. And you don't have to be Catholic to call. Anybody can call. We have come up to our first break. However, before I send you off to that first break, Catholic Answers Shop has digital videos available now, and they're on sale. And many people might not know this. You probably remember, maybe you've at some point gotten a DVD from Catholic Answers. Well, many of those DVDs are now available in downloadable video formats, and you can do that at shop.catholic.com. Look for the new digital video category at shop.catholic.com.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. Unplanned.
Available at EWTNRC.com and the EWTN app.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. What a great Friday show we have for you. Jimmy Akin is our guest both hours, but we're going to do something different each hour. This hour, it's open forum, which is a bonus. We've got an open forum with Jimmy on a Friday, and you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Second hour is weird questions with Jimmy Akin. For some reason, Jimmy has the reputation of being amenable to and able to answer weird questions. And so we get a lot of weird questions for Jimmy Akin, so we take some time to work through them, and I can assure you, there are some weird ones today. All right, now let's go to Tucson, Arizona, watching on YouTube Live. Carlos in Tucson. Thank you so much, Carlos, for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. I just got done with your apologetics course. It was very helpful.
Awesome.
And I'm taking on the apologetics approach. However, my question is, you tend to stumble upon very dark and disturbing stuff when researching other religions or practices. What are the limits for an apologetic, for apologetics to, you know, what you can explore, research, learn to be able to, you know, help explain things to common people?
Well, I don't think there are any limits in principle. I mean, obviously there are limits to human knowledge, but within things that are going on in other religious communities, I don't think there's anything in principle that is off limits for an apologist, because there are people in these other religions, and yeah, there are dark and disturbing things in some of them, and those people in particular, the ones who are into the dark, disturbing stuff, really need God's grace. And it can help to have apologists who are able to articulate the problems with these things and also articulate the positive alternatives to them that are in Christianity. And so I would say that it's really the people who are into the darkest stuff that need the help the most. And so apologists, you know, to the extent that they're able, should try to help them. Now, every apologist has his own predilections, his own skill set, his own inclinations, his own limitations, and you want to know those. You don't want to push yourself unnecessarily beyond where you're personally comfortable, and so forth. For example, I'm not a big fan of Satanism. Not only am I opposed to it, but also I just don't like reading about it.
Uh-huh.
And so I have not read the Satanic Bible. I have not studied Satanism closely. I know some about it, I'm comfortable with having a certain level of knowledge, but I don't really want to do a deep dive into Satanism. That's just a personal limitation of mine. But I trust that God, you know, and there aren't many Satanists, fortunately, but I trust that God will give other apologists inclinations and aptitudes that are different than mine, and he'll arrange one way or another for people who are into Satanism to get the help they need.
Okay, Carlos?
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Carlos. Just so you know, because I'm doing the ad a little later, the courses are on sale right now over at the School of Apologetics. So if you want to take some more, check it out at School of Apologetics. Thanks again, Carlos. I'm going to go to Oregon now. Calvin in Oregon, watching on YouTube Live. You are next, Calvin. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
This is a moral question that's been bugging me for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say a child is being kidnapped. And he's being held next door to a house that I know about it. It would be a sin for me not to do something, at least call the police, say, hey, the kid's here and all this.
Mm-hmm.
God is without sin. So why wouldn't God let us know where that child is instead of letting that child be kept? Let's say he's being kept kidnapped there for years and years and years and years and years, and nobody gets anything tortured all this time, and we don't get to, and God doesn't tell us where that child is.
Okay. So this is a version of what's known as the problem of evil. And the problem of evil is something that theologians and philosophers have thought about for millennia, actually, for thousands of years. And Christian theologians in particular have been thinking about it for the last 2,000 years. And there is this, question that at times people really can struggle with. Why would a good God allow evil things to go on if he could stop them? And there have been various answers that have been proposed. Some of them are more helpful than others. Some of them just don't work. And it would be wrong to say we have a complete answer to this question. We don't, because God's knowledge goes beyond ours. But there are some things that can be said that I think are helpful here. One of them is precisely because God has... So the basic answer is because God would not allow an evil to occur if he didn't have a way to bring an equal or greater good out of it. So God would stop any evil from happening unless he was going to bring about a greater good. That's what the Catechism of the Catholic Church says. Now, we can't always see what that greater good is. And in that respect, it's a little bit like when you're a kid and you're maybe, say, 1, 2, 3 years old, and your parents are taking you to the doctor for your childhood injections. Well, from the perspective of a child, this is evil. This is just meaning it involves physical pain and fear, which are physical evils. Your parents, who take care of you normally, suddenly seem to betray you, and they take you to this scary place, and strangers are holding you down, and they're inserting a sharp object into your body, and it stings, and you're crying and afraid, and you don't know why your parents are doing this. Why are they letting this happen? They're right there. They brought you here. Well, what the child doesn't understand is actually, even though this experience does involve physical evils like fear and pain, it's actually going to be of help to the child. It's going to prevent the child from getting horrible diseases that would cause vastly more suffering and maybe even death in the future. You know, there are a lot of childhood diseases that used to kill lots of kids, but vaccinations prevent that. And so what we as adults can recognize is that we can learn something from that experience. We know that even though it wasn't obvious to the child at the time, that there was a good reason for the parents and the doctors to do that to the child, for the parents to allow that and for the doctor to do it. And we can trust God, our Father in heaven, he's our parent too in an even greater way. We can trust that he has reasons for allowing us to experience pain and fear and suffering, even though we may not know what the reason is right now. We're sort of in the position of the small child who doesn't have the full picture, whereas God does have the full picture. And presumably in the next life, and this is something the Catechism also says, we'll have more information. God will let us know the reasons why he allowed these things. So we won't be forever without understanding. Also, God himself, for anyone who suffers innocently, God himself will make it up to that person. St. Paul in his letters acknowledges that there is suffering in this life, but he says that the current suffering we have is weak and momentary, and it's not worth comparing to the great glory that God has in store for us. And so as a result, St. Paul teaches us that
despite the sufferings we encounter in this life, God will more than make them up to us. And so those things, even though they don't answer every question we would have about why God allows particular evils, they at least sketch a framework that helps us understand why a good God would allow these evils. He's ultimately going to bring good out of them, and he will make sure that people who have suffered innocently will be more than compensated. I have given a talk on this subject, Calvin. It's creatively titled The Problem of Evil. And if you hang on the line, let's see if we can send Calvin a DVD of it.
All right. Calvin, please do hang on the line. If you'd like, give your address to Marie, and I will send you out a DVD of Jimmy's talk, The Problem of Evil. Our number here is 888-318-7884. Anyone welcome to call, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, you are welcome to call with your question for Jimmy Akin. And now we are going to Memphis, Tennessee. Samia in Memphis, Tennessee, also watching on YouTube Live. Big YouTube day today. Samia, you there with us?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hello. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes. I came across a movie on Netflix. It's a speaking movie about the apparitions in Garbandal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first time I hear about it, so I
Okay, Samia, you're fading in and out. Can you put your mouth right next to the phone?
Do you hear me better now?
Oh, that's better.
Good. So I was just saying that I had never heard about the apparitions, and I found it to be quite interesting since this is a very recent apparition in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And when I attempted to read about it, all what I got was that the church's position is an overall confusion regarding the apparitions. And so I wonder if you could teach me something about this.
So when an apparition is reported, a bishop may choose to begin an investigation of it. And the bishop for that area has, in the past, has done some investigation and concluded as a result of that investigation that there wasn't sufficient evidence to approve these apparitions, and so they are not approved by the Catholic Church. Now, every apparition that gets popular obviously has followers, otherwise it wouldn't be popular. And when a bishop says, you know, there's no basis for this or we can't prove it or things like that, that's a disappointment to the followers of a particular apparition, and there will be a natural tendency on their part to try to portray the results of the bishop's investigation as positively as they can. So they will say things like, oh, well, this doesn't condemn the apparition, you know, or they will say it's not approved yet, implying it will be approved one day. Or if the bishop does outright condemn the apparition, they'll say, well, that was his opinion, but, you know, he was misinformed or something like that. In the case of the Garibandal apparitions, they weren't condemned in the sense of this is heretical, but there was an investigation that concluded that it was not shown that there wasn't evidence of them being of genuinely supernatural origin.
Does that help you, Samia?
Yes, it does very much. Thank you very much, Jimmy. And thank you, Sai. God bless your ministry.
Oh, thank you so much. God bless you. And thank you for the call. Our number is 888-318-7884. Kind of an opportunity for you. Usually on Thursdays, people know Jimmy's coming, and so the line gets full. And there's some spots you can get in if you've got a question for Jimmy Akin. 888-318-7884. Up next, is it all YouTube day? Are we on anywhere else? It's another YouTube viewer, Jim in Greenbelt, Maryland, watching on YouTube Live. You are up next, Jim. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. Yeah, I wanted to ask Jimmy about the remote viewing that he was mentioning earlier. And
sure.
I know that in the Catechism, it warns us against psychics and things like that, and I wondered if that was covered under that or if I'm misunderstanding that.
So the Catechism actually doesn't warn us against psychics. What it warns against is divination. And divination is understood, and by the way, we're going to hit the break, so I'll have to continue this on the other side. But divination is a practice, and there are different versions of it, but it's a practice that uses improper ways of trying to, for example, predict the future. And what the way the Catechism phrases it is, it has a list of practices that it's sounding a caution about, and it identifies the problem with them as they falsely unveil the future. So if something falsely unveils the future, it's something we need to stay away from. There's more to say, though, and we'll say it on the other side of the break.
All right. I hope you can hang on, Jim. We will be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. Still a couple lines open, 888-318-7884. Right back after this.
Call us now with your question.
Hello?
On Catholic Answers Live.
According to divine command, we should give God worship, but how do we know if we're doing it right? Is worship a form of self-help? To make me feel better? A form of social activism or even a commodity? Or is it something that transcends all of those? In Real Religion, How to Avoid False Faith and Worship God in Spirit and Truth, Father Jeff Kirby cuts through the misguided modern notions about God and religion and takes you back to the foundation for true worship. God's revelation about himself. From his first contact with his chosen people to the culmination of his revelation in Jesus Christ, God shows us what religion is supposed to be like and how to make the practice of it a lifelong virtue in our lives. Order your copy of Real Religion by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Matt Swaim here. Join us for a Monday edition of the Sunrise Morning Show when we'll mark the anniversary of the death of Servant of God Julia Greeley with Sister Josephine Garrett. Now back to Catholic Answers Live on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this Friday afternoon where we are. Thank you for taking the time to be with us. Second hour, we got Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Always a lot of fun. This hour, it's open forum. You can ask Jimmy whatever you like. And Jim in Maryland was asking about the morality of remote viewing. And you were explaining some of the distinctions about what's...
So in the Catechism section on divination, it talks about various practices. And actually, it's in this divination is part of what it talks about in the section on superstition. And it talks about various practices. Some of them involve like calling up demons, okay? And actually, people may be surprised to learn this, but in the Middle Ages, there actually was a movement, not an organized movement, but there was a current of thought in the church, including by priests, because they were the educated ones who were arguing that it's okay to call up demons and then try to bind them in the name of Christ to do your bidding. because the argument was, well, God gave them power and all things come from God and it's not wrong to use powers that God created. So we could whistle up a demon and then bind him in the name of Christ to do what we want him to do and have him do some kind of good. And St. Thomas Aquinas said, you total fools.
Uh-huh.
You cannot trust these guys. Do not mess with them at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I agree with St. Thomas on that. So does the Catechism. The Catechism says don't have anything to do with demons. Also, the Catechism warns against calling up the spirits of departed human beings because that's explicitly forbidden in the Bible. That's in Deuteronomy. And then it has these other practices that it says falsely unveil the future, so don't mess with them. And it names, among other things, you know, horoscopes and things like that. It also refers to traditional practices, like medical healing practices that may invoke spirits and stuff like that, and it says those are bad too. So it does list a number of different categories of things that we do need to stay away from. But what it doesn't do is say there are no undiscovered or poorly researched human abilities and that we need to stay away from those things. And so there have been Catholic theologians, including doctors of the church, like St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, who down through the years who have held that humans have weak natural abilities that today we would call psychic. St. Thomas Aquinas, for example, talked about essentially what we would today call precognition, and which is, you know, having a glimpse of the future in one way or another. And he thought humans have this as a natural ability. He called it natural prophecy to distinguish it from the supernatural prophecy that God gives.
Oh.
And he would say, okay, now supernatural prophecy, because it comes from God and God don't make mistakes, that's always right. You know, if God reveals something to a prophet, okay, it's certain. He would say natural prophecy, on the other hand, is driven by human nature picking up on clues that are out there that are hidden to our normal senses. So this is a form of extrasensory perception, or ESP, in modern terms. And it's probabilistic. So it's not guaranteed to be right the way divine prophecy is. So, you know, that's a subject that the Catechism doesn't address. Are there natural human abilities that go beyond the conventional ones like sight and smell and taste and hearing and so forth? Well, it's not a teaching of the faith that such things don't exist. In fact, there are even, you could argue there are some parts of divine revelation that could even suggest this, like, how do departed souls communicate? They don't have lips. They don't have vocal tracts.
Oh, right.
How do they communicate? It would seem to be some kind of mind-to-mind communication. Also, how about angels?
Mm-hmm.
You know, angels are totally non-physical beings, but they can communicate with each other, and they can affect things in the world. You know, they can affect matter, for example, like when the angel rolls away the rock,
right?
You know? And so, well, okay, if angels, who are purely intellectual beings, are able to talk to each other mind to mind, we would call that telepathy.
Yeah.
And if they're able to move matter around, we would call that telekinesis. So there are even some hints that angelic spirits have those abilities. But guess what? Humans have spirits too.
Right.
Maybe our spirits were not as strong as angels, but maybe our spirits have something like that. And it would then be, it's not a teaching of the faith that we don't. Divine revelation doesn't say that we don't. And so that would then put it in the realm of reason to investigate, do we have such abilities? It would make it a matter for scientific investigation. And various modern parapsychological studies try to do exactly that. You know, they try to investigate, do we have these weak natural abilities that go beyond what we're conventionally aware of? And some people would have looked at the studies and said, yeah, the studies support the existence of these things. Skeptics, on the other hand, look at the studies and say, I don't think so. So it's a matter of debate. If it turned out that God did give us these weak natural abilities, then as long as we would be using them the way he intended, the presumption would be you can use them. Because God didn't give us abilities and then forbid us to use them under all circumstances.
Right, right.
You know, the presumption would be unless we have a command from God, which we don't, saying never use these abilities I gave you, then presumably there would be at least some circumstances in which it would be moral to do so. But all of that's beyond the catechism. The catechism doesn't try to address that stuff. It's concerned with specific areas that have already been identified as superstitious.
Okay, Jim?
Yeah, that's good information, guys. That expression about false information about the future, I guess, doesn't necessarily mean that the information you're getting is false, but just you're getting it from a bad source that's trying to deceive you in some way or another.
Well, it can mean that, but it also can just be something that's so unreliable it's not worth using. You know, like if I were to roll a six-sided die, you know, I'm probably not going to get much information about the future based on a dice roll. So
right.
It would be, even if there's no spirit involved, you know, just rolling a die is not a reliable way to predict what's going to happen. So, sorry, the magic eight ball is not really that helpful. You might use it as a party game, but you don't want to actually believe what it tells you. And so whether there's a deceptive source of information involved or whether it's just a wildly unreliable method, you want to be careful of such things.
Jim, thank you. I appreciate the call and the question. Where am I going now? I think I'm going all the way to South Carolina. Timothy in Goose Creek, South Carolina, watching on YouTube Live. Nice to have you with us, Timothy. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, how's it going, Jimmy?
Going okay.
Hey, so I had a quick question. It kind of seems like an apparent contradiction in the Bible when Jesus tells us that we're not supposed to worry, you know, he talks about the sparrows. But then in the Garden of Gethsemane, he, you know, it seems like there's a lot of anxiety. I mean, he's sweating bullets of blood. So I just wanted your thoughts on that.
So when Jesus cautions against worry, he does that in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. And if you read the full context, he says, you know, don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow has enough worry on its own. And he says the worry of the day is sufficient for the day. So what he's cautioning against is not having concern or even anxiety about danger. Anxiety is just another way of saying fear. He's not saying we should never have fear. In fact, elsewhere he says things like fear the one who can cast body and soul into hell. What he's cautioning against is excessive worry and like dwelling on future disasters that may or may not happen. But he acknowledges that it's okay to have concern about and thus worry about the things you're immediately confronted with. That's what he means when he says that the worry of each day is sufficient for that day. You got enough to worry about today. Don't mess with worrying about the future. Even that is a guideline. He doesn't mean it literally. If you know you've got a disease or something that's going to be worse tomorrow than today, you know, or if you know something could happen tomorrow that would be bad, you could take steps to prevent it today. But this is basically a caution against excessive worry. And so when you're right up to a point where you know you're going to die, which is what Jesus is experiencing in the Garden of Gethsemane. He knows his death is hours away. It is natural to have fear and apprehension. God made us averse to death. We have a natural instinct to fear death and try to avoid it. That's actually a survival strategy. God put that into us so we would try to survive. And so it's actually a healthy instinct to try to be death averse and to try to avoid encountering death. That's a healthy instinct. It serves us well in most cases. But when death is unavoidable, we're still going to have that death aversion. And so it's
not unexpected that as Jesus is about to die and knows it, that he's experiencing death aversion as well. That's a natural thing. It's part of human nature. And it's not excessive worry, because death is the greatest of the physical evils, and from one perspective, and Jesus is about to encounter it. But you'll notice he's not worrying about his death 3 years from now. He's worrying about it today. So he's accepting the worry of the day, the trouble of the day, being sufficient for the day.
Timothy, thank you so much. Appreciate that question. Lots of folks on the line. We're going to try to get to as many as we can before the top of the hour. Jimmy Akin, our guest. We've got a free ebook for you on the Inquisition and the Crusades. Lots of people would like to have a better understanding of what happened with the Inquisitions of the and the Crusades. Many Catholics would like to have some explanation that they could offer others when challenged about the Crusades and the Inquisition. Well, you can get this book, The Real Story of the Crusades and the Inquisition, free. It's an ebook available for free at shop.catholic.com.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He is honored by the church as a saint with the title of the Seraphic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
One of the greatest theologians and Franciscan mystics in church history, Bonaventure also wrote a biography of St. Francis that was commissioned by the Franciscans themselves. It took a saint and true mystic to understand a true saint and mystic. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Lots of folks on the line. So right back to the phones we go. Charlene in Eastern Washington State, watching on YouTube Live. You are next, Charlene. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. I have been a Catholic for 20 years and one day.
Hey. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. I just want to share that. My question is this. My mother, like all mothers, is going to die. Mine's going to die fairly soon from chronic disease, which is the thing that happened. She's elderly, and but the question is this: my brother, who is Orthodox, seems to be pushing for my mom. We're kind of all in agreement about cremation, but he's kind of pushing for her remains to be scattered on the waters. Now, we can't concern ourselves with what the Orthodox believe, because there are so many different Orthodox churches. No one knows. They don't have a fixed doctrine. But if he were a Catholic, if I was, is it okay for me as a Catholic? Let's pretend that I was saying, you know, she'd really like to have her remains scattered on the waters. Let's do that. Is that okay? Or my particular position that I have taken is I would prefer that she be interred in holy ground. I have a plot. It won't cost you anything. So am I, as a Catholic, allowed to say, yeah, let's scatter our ashes also?
Is your mom a Catholic, Charlene?
She's not a Catholic. She was baptized by the Lutherans. She's a nominal Christian.
Okay. Since she is not a Catholic, she is not bound by canon law. And therefore, I would say that her wishes in this matter should prevail. Now, you and your brother may want to present her with options and encourage her to think about them, but I wouldn't have either one of you pressure her. This really should be her decision, what she wants to have happen. Does she want to be cremated or not? Does she want her ashes put in a particular to be interred somewhere or scattered? It's really a question for her. It is not the traditional Catholic way to honor the dead to scatter ashes.
100 years ago, it wasn't, or a little more than that, it actually wasn't even the Catholic way to have cremation. But cremation is not against divine law unless you load it up with other, you know, assumptions like I'm doing this as a sign of defiance of the resurrection or something. You know, there's nothing wrong with the cremation itself. There are good prudential reasons for keeping ashes together, and that's part of why it's our custom, but it's not a matter of divine law that you have to keep the ashes together. In fact, there are lots of situations in the world, historically especially. I mean, most people's bodies have not survived the ages intact. They haven't always been in one place. You know, if you do a burial at sea, for example, which is perfectly legitimate, without cremation, sea life forms are going to deal with the body. If you haven't embalmed somebody by mummification or by using something like formaldehyde, then microorganisms, if you bury them in the ground, microorganisms are going to result in the body not remaining fully intact. And so you don't have to, by divine law, struggle to keep every atom of the person's body in one location. Historically, because of the way Catholic culture has evolved, and for prudential reasons, it has not been our way to scatter ashes. And so canon law does not allow the scattering of ashes for Catholics. But your mom is not a Catholic, and so she would not be violating divine law if she chose to have her ashes scattered. She wouldn't be violating church law since she's not a Catholic and is not bound by church law. And so I would say it's really up to her to make this decision. And while you and your brother can present her with options and tell her which ones you would personally prefer, I wouldn't fight about it. Now, in terms of what happens afterwards, so if your mom said, well, I would like to be cremated and have my ashes scattered, you would not be doing anything wrong to say, okay, I accept that, and I love you, and we'll carry out your wishes, because she is not bound to do things. She's not a Catholic, and she's not bound to do things the Catholic way. You could similarly attend the service and participate in it as a sign of love and respect, not just for your mom, but for all of your relatives. And so that's kind of a general sketch of how I'd approach the subject. Now, if your mom is not currently in a position to make this decision, not everybody has full mental function as they near the end of their life, well, then it's something that you and your siblings may need to figure out. But regardless of what happens, I would strive to not make this a family-breaking issue, because it doesn't need to be. I would suggest you that everybody approach this as serenely as they can without staking out this must or must not happen positions, because the fact is your mom has freedom. If she had full use of her faculties, it would be entirely up to her to decide what she wants. And so that means these various options are on the table, morally speaking, and so nobody should stake out, we must do it this way, and I'm going to be mad at you forever if we don't.
Charlene, thank you so much. I hope that was helpful to you. Lots of folks on the line, so I am going to keep moving and try to get folks on with Jimmy before we have to end this hour. Next hour, weird questions with Jimmy Akin. So Jimmy will stay with us, and we'll do some weird questions. Roy in Houston, Texas, listening on AM 1430 Guadalupe Radio. You are next, Roy. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey there. So had a question about the Trinity. Not the reason for it, but why did God create it? Because he's omnipresent, right? So realistically, God the Father could have come down and done everything.
God didn't create the Trinity. This is part of what we say in the Creed when we, for example, talk about the Son and the Holy Spirit. We'll say that the Son was begotten, not made. So the Son is the Son is not made, he's not a creature, and the same, he's not created. And the same is true of the Holy Spirit. They both come from the Father eternally outside of time. So the Son and the Spirit have just always been there. They are, as persons, you know, the Son is begotten by the Father and the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father through the Son, but that's an eternal relationship that has never changed and can never change. So the Trinity just exists. It is not something that ever has been different. In terms of God's actions outside of the Trinity, the theologians typically understand that all three persons cooperate in every action that God does outside of the Trinity. So, for example, you may notice passages in the New Testament that talk about the role of the Son in the act of creation. They'll say that, you know, at the beginning of John's Gospel, for example, it talks about how everything was created through the Logos, through Jesus, through the Son. And there are other passages where St. Paul talks about how everything was created through him. And if you look in the Psalms, it talks about how the heavens were made by the Word of God, that's the Son, and by the breath of his mouth, that's the Spirit. The word for Spirit and breath are the same in Hebrew and Greek. So we see in that passage the Father depicted as speaking the world into creation through his Word and his breath, and that indicates a cooperation of all three persons in the Trinity. And it's understood similarly that when it comes to the work of redemption that occurred through at the time of Jesus, all three persons again cooperated, but they have different roles. So the Father sent Jesus, Jesus was the one to come, and the Holy Spirit also played a role in this. He played a role in raising Jesus from the dead, and he was there at Pentecost, and he applies grace and promotes conversion to Jesus. And so again, all three persons are cooperating, but they play different roles. Now, could God have chosen to do it differently? It's an interesting question. The church doesn't have a teaching on that point, so I would say it's a matter of speculation. Could God have made different choices about which person of the Trinity would do what? But it would only be a matter of speculation. What we do know is these are the choices God made, and that all three persons are involved in everything that God does outside of his inner life.
Roy, thank you. I'm going to keep moving, see if we can get one more, at least one more, and before we have to go. Ed in Alexandria, Virginia. I think you are next, Ed. Ed watching on YouTube. Go ahead, Ed, with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. Big fans of both of you. Sorry, I'm reading your book.
Thank you, Ed.
Now and any number of Jimmy's books, and of course, Mysterious World. So I'm a really big fan of both. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, in Matthew 27, it refers to the veil of the temple being rent and from top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if are we to take that literally? That literally happened?
Yeah, I don't see why not. It's not, and it's not just reported in Matthew, but this is a
in other places. Well.
Yeah, this is a report that we find in the gospel tradition. There's no, while it does have symbolic value, and you know there are several different proposed things that this could symbolize. Just because an action has symbolic value doesn't mean that it didn't literally happen. It's like when Jesus rides into Jerusalem at the triumphal entry, he's riding on a donkey, he's fulfilling Old Testament prophecy, and there is symbolic value because he's saying by this riding in this way, I'm the Messiah. So yeah. There is symbolic value, but it still really happened. And in the same way, the tearing of the temple I have no reason to say that it's purely a symbol. It occurs in a historical narrative. It occurs in multiple different documents. And there are other reports from this general time period of very unusual things happening in the temple. If you go to the Jewish historian Josephus, for example, he talks about similar signs occurring in the temple as its destruction was approaching.
Uh-huh.
And this is, if you notice, there's a connection between Jesus and the temple in the Gospels. Jesus physically represents the temple. So like in John, he says, tear down this temple and in 3 days I'll raise it up. and he's talking about his body. The destruction of Jesus' body on the cross foreshadows the destruction of the temple, and thus there is, it's natural to find these omens occurring both when Jesus dies and in AD 70 when the temple's about to be destroyed.
Ed, thank you very much for that question. I'm sorry we weren't able to get to more, but we got to a lot, but there's we had plenty, a good supply of callers, so we'll have to ask you to call next week, because next hour, it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. People send us weird questions, and Jimmy gathers them up for us, and every now and then, we take an hour to answer them. We'll do that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.